Welcome to On the Mic Podcast. This is your host, Tim Drake. On today's episode, I have writer and author Alisa Jordan. Alisa and I have known each other for a few years now, working together at Warner Brothers, but never really truly knew some of her passions outside of working around the lot, including being an author. So she just released her second book called Hello, Norma Jean, The Marilyn Monroe You Didn't Know. I always knew Alisa had a really deep fascination with a lot of the classic films and also was just a big history buff. And so to see her release a book like this was no surprise to me, but I was so fascinated to dive into this book as I myself have also always been a fan of Marilyn Monroe. And boy, does Alisa not disappoint in this. So it really takes you through every step of her life, growing up and becoming one of the biggest stars ever in Hollywood. It's probably still to this day one of the biggest stars to ever grace Hollywood. But it's a really fascinating read, and I can't encourage you guys enough to check it out, especially any of you that are fans of Marilyn Monroe. You guys are absolutely going to love this. Also kind of a surprise, as I had bought the book, I noticed that Alisa had written a prior book about Rockhaven Sanitarium. So now, if you guys remember, if you followed our 31 Days of Horror, Rockhaven was a place that we had visited to kind of talk about its alleged hauntings. And it was a place that was just so incredibly fascinating to me. It was a very, very peaceful place. And talking to Alisa more about that, learning a little bit more of the history through her, it was very fascinating to hear. That book is called Rockhaven Sanitarium, The Legacy of Agnes Richards, one that I'm very excited to dive into coming up here. But yeah, it was great to talk with Alisa, find out more of her passion about the history of Los Angeles. She is a rare commodity here in Los Angeles, where she is native to Southern California, growing up in Orange County. We talk a little bit about why that is so rare on the show. But it was a really great chat with Alisa, and I think you guys are really going to have a good time learning more about her. So, of course, it has been a while since we've released a podcast, basically since last summer after San Diego Comic-Con. We keep trying to get things going again with the podcast, and, you know, there's always been something since the pandemic that's kind of stood in the way. But I think we finally have a way to get things back rolling, back to normal. We've already got several episodes banked and ready to go. So there shouldn't be any further interruptions. So, of course, we filmed a feature film coming out of the pandemic. So getting everything involved with that, going to film festivals kind of course, threw a wrench in some things. And then as soon as things started going again, we ended up having strikes here in Hollywood. And so people couldn't come on and promote the projects they wanted to promote. And so it's just kind of been a ringer over the last 4 years of being able to get things going again. But I'm very happy to say the podcast is back. We've got a lot of great episodes to come, and including our 200th episode. Did something really fun for the 200th episode that you guys will hear in the coming weeks. But thank you so much for your patience and for sticking along throughout the last several years, as things have been a little wonky on our end. But I'm so happy to have the podcast back and so happy for you guys to hear all the interviews that have been recorded so far and so many great ones to come down the line. So thank you again to Alisa Jordan. Please check out her book, Hello, Norma Jean, The Marilyn Monroe You Didn't Know, as well as Rockhaven Sanitarium, The Legacy of Agnes Richards. Both incredible books, and I'm very excited, like I said, to read this Rockhaven Sanitarium one. I'm so fascinated about the place, and I think there's such a unique story to be told there. And again, Hello, Norma Jean. I'm planning to take this book with me in the car so I can visit some of the spots Alisa walks us through in the book. But thank you again to Alisa Jordan. Thank you again for your patience and for listening to the show. I hope you guys enjoy this episode. We will see you next week. There is no rhyme or reason to it. So, I mean,
there's no method to the madness.
Yeah, cat stories galore. That's what people live for, at least to my understanding.
Oh, I have cat stories like you would not believe. Because in my writing career, I used to write the breed profiles for Cat Fancy magazine.
Oh, wait, really?
For years. Yeah.
So that's kind of amazing. So I mean, here I am thinking, all right, we're gonna go down, Alisa does all of this with like Hollywood, like deep into Hollywood history, into Hollywood tours, and it all starts with Cat Fancy.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah, I was in pet publishing for forever.
That is kind of crazy. So we will definitely dive back into that.
Okay, we can go wherever you want.
I'm glad that we were able to set the time to do this. Like, as I kind of told you, like the podcast during the pandemic just kind of fell by the wayside. And every time I try to like bring it back around, something else happens. And it's just
Yeah,
like,
that's how life
I mean,
goes.
nothing necessarily bad. I mean, started bringing it back around and then I made a movie. And then started bringing it back around, but then strikes happened.
Yeah.
And so it was like, okay, now it's time to really bring it back full force.
So, speaking of movies, did you see? I posted it in the employee group. Ryan Gosling has just signed a big deal with one of the producers who worked on Barbie, and they did not go with Warner
I
Brothers.
saw that they went with a Amazon and MGM, which I was very shocked by, especially after just seeing, everything Jake Gyllenhaal went through with, Roadhouse, thinking that, oh, it's going to be a theatrical release. That's what they told everybody, and then boom, it just hits Prime. So I was kind of surprised to see, yeah, a major star immediately take it to Amazon and MGM. So, but hey, we did ink the big Timothy Chalamet deal. So that I guess we kind of got a trade off there. So, for everybody listening though, Elisa and I got to know each other because we worked together at Warner Brothers. So, and kind of just started sharing a bond over a lot of the old classic films, and have known each other for a few years now. You were a part-time employee for the longest time, so I'd usually only see you on the weekends.
Weekends, yeah. Now I'm full time.
Yeah,
So now
now that you're full time, I see you every day.
yeah, I live there.
So when I had gotten injured almost a year ago now, so and I would just kind of hit in the offices for every single day. I would see nobody. I would just kind of sidle in. And then I'd peek my head into other areas, and people would, "Oh, you still work here?" So I know the feeling because,
What's your name again?
yeah, there are still people whose names I do not know because of all the time I was just gonna spend hidden away. But amidst all that, then all of a sudden I start to see, like, as I started seeing you around more, that you had a book come out about Marilyn Monroe, and I started kind of looking through it, and I was just like, oh, this is fascinating. Like, I didn't know, Elisa, like, I knew that you were a writer, but I didn't know all that you had actually kind of done. Even when I bought your book, I throw your name into the Amazon chat or into the Amazon search, and immediately what pops up with it, I just see this next book down for the Rockhaven Sanitarium, and I'm like, oh, cool, I didn't know there was a book on this. And I go to click, I'm like, wait, Elisa wrote this. Like, I didn't know you had done that. So it made it even more. I was like, okay, I want to find out more about, like, how you got started, kind of your backstory, because you're native Californian, right?
Am, yeah.
Yeah, which is
Where are you
rare.
from?
So I grew up in Utah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm told that I'm rare, and it's so funny because growing up here, I grew up around a lot of other people who grew up here. So it's funny to me that it's just like we're rare, really? I know a whole bunch of us. But I will say this, and this kind of breaks my heart, is a lot of the people I grew up with have moved away because they can't afford to live here anymore, which is sad because I think there are some stereotypes about living in Southern California that everyone lives on the beach and drives expensive cars and lives in mansions. And in reality, there are a lot of just normal people. And it's getting harder to be a normal people in Southern California.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I mean, as quickly as people come out, though, they seem to come right back. They seem to come right back in. Like, our state's just always filled with people trying to kind of get to that dream. But yeah, I think that is why it makes people like yourself so rare, that our natives, is so many natives are like, yeah, we've seen it and done it our whole life. But like, I can pay the same amount of money and get a couple acres in, Utah or something, so that I can
Yeah,
get
and
to a
I
few
don't
bedrooms.
blame people for taking that option. I really don't. I'm kind of lucky here. I have family here, so that makes it easier. But if I didn't have family here, I wouldn't be able to be here.
Yeah, it's definitely. I know for me, even though I don't have family here, it became years ago, and I had interviewed Jim O'Hare and mentioned that you know, working in this industry is literally the only thing I could ever see myself doing. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, then you'll find a way to do it. And he's like, because you don't have an option. Like, then you'll find a way. And that's really what it became for me, was it was just like, okay, like I know I could have, you know, I mean, when I owned my house in Utah, I mean, we had a 5-bedroom, 2-bath house on a 1/4 acre that my wife and I had.
Wow.
That we sold back in 2013. And like, we'd fixed it up, made a little money on it when we sold it. And I am paying now for rent for a 1-bedroom apartment more than double what my mortgage was.
Easy. Yeah.
It's a little more than double what my mortgage was. And that's just kind of crazy. But at the same time, I wouldn't have it any other way, because it's just like, it's what makes, like, my parents, sometimes I have to remind them, like, you just have to do what makes you happy. Like, I can't compare myself to my sister who still lives in Utah, or one of my brothers who lives in Iowa. Like, yeah, they can, you know, get things really cheap, because, as I always like to say, because no one else wants to live there. So, and that is no offense to anybody listening in any of those states, but California, we kind of have, I mean, you've, like, where you're at, Disneyland's pretty close. Uh-huh. I mean, Disneyland's an hour for me. We've got the beach 20 minutes one way, and the mountains and skiing and stuff an hour the other way. So there's a lot of opportunity here. And sadly, it makes our cost of living just continue to grow and grow and grow.
Yeah, a couple things. So my first job was Disneyland. I can't remember if I ever told you that, but no, that was my first job. And I knew from a very young age, I just didn't want, how can I put this without sounding terrible, but I knew I wasn't cut out for regular suburban life. But there are people who aren't cut out for the kind of life that I like. So yeah. I'm not saying anything bad. You know, there's just different strokes for different folks. And so I didn't want to go get a job at a kiosk in the mall or at Orange Julius or whatever, because I just knew I was unable to function in something like that. So I got a job at Disneyland. I was there for a long time. I started in high school and then worked my way through college there. And the thing about living in Southern California is it's always been probably more expensive than other places, but at the same time, you know, there were middle-class neighborhoods. That's, you know, I come from a working middle-class family. And that's kind of going away. And I saw it really start to change around 2000 when we had that first big real estate bubble with the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae.
Yeah.
And housing prices went up and rent prices followed. And even though we had the bubble burst, it only came down a little bit. It never came back down to where it was. And there's been a huge gap between housing prices and income ever since. So it's been about, gosh, you know, almost 25 years now. But it didn't used to be like that. It was, if you could work a full-time job, you could at least afford an apartment. Right. And that's not necessarily the case anymore.
Yeah, it's definitely gotten crazy. And we've been looking to move from our apartment. I mean, we've been here almost 7 years in this apartment. But we've definitely been looking to jump closer over to Burbank. I mean, I say that as I'm 15 minutes away. I don't have the hour commute that you have, but still, just moving over somewhere where it's a little bit quieter. There's parking. And looking through it just to try to maintain living close to work. It's just astronomical pricing. And it's like, I work 40 hours. My wife works 40 hours. Like, we work for a major studio. How are we not? And the housing prices are just so high in comparison to the wages. And I mean, compared to what even we make here in Southern California, our wages are higher than a lot of those other states, but there still is just, it's just kind of crazy of what it takes for us to actually kind of survive. But I like the way that you put it. Like, you realize that you weren't cut out for just kind of the regular suburban life. And that's definitely how it is for both my wife and I too, is I'd realized very early on, like, I can't do just the suburban neighborhood kind of living. Like, I needed that excitement. I needed something different every day. And I think, we're lucky. Very, very lucky that we get to do it.
Yeah, we are very lucky, and I've always been grateful that I came from here. And you know, my fascination with Hollywood started very young, and I realized, like, wait a minute, we're just a freeway ride away from where all this happens. Can we go? Like, Mom, can we go? Can we go see this? And you know, when you come to Hollywood, there's really nothing to see other than touristy stuff because you're not
Right.
going to, you know. It's not like a zoo where you're going to go to this one area and see a bunch of celebrities and they'll wave at you, which is, I think, what people expect when they come to Warner Brothers. But you know, it was just fascinating. Like, I get to live here? Wow. And then that never really went away. As an adult, I'm still kind of like that. And it's not so much being starstruck, it's about I get to live in an area where there's so much creativity and there's options for people who kind of struggle to fit in, you know, like I guess I'm kind of the Wednesday Addams or I guess I'm like more in that vein than your typical suburban kid.
Yeah, I definitely felt the same way. That's where this, I think my family would come out here all the time to do the typical go to Disneyland. And every time we would come out here, it always felt like home to me. And I think it's because I always recognized exactly what you're saying, that yeah, it did feel like that place that anybody had, you know, a welcome spot. So, I mean, in Utah, a lot of people don't really leave the same neighborhood. I mean, a lot of people I went to high school with lived some many in the same neighborhood their parents do. So their kids have all gone to the same elementary, the same high school, and it's just a secular thing. And I mean, a lot of communities are like that. But when all of a sudden you're the kid who's like, you know what, I'm gonna go give that Hollywood thing a try. That's
And it
everybody
can
thinks the
be
same.
hard. It's hard being that kid knowing you're a little different.
Yeah.
Because kids just want to be friends with other kids and have, you know, like interests and everything. And when you're the weird kid, not that I didn't stand out that much. I was the quiet kid, but I knew I wanted different things than the kids I had grown up with. They were all making plans to get married and start families and get real jobs. And I'm like, let's go to the Whiskey a Go-Go and see who's playing, you know?
So, I mean, even growing up in Southern California, did you find that a lot of people didn't want to gravitate towards Hollywood, or was there still a little bit more?
Yeah, because we were far enough, like we were close enough to go whenever we wanted to, but far enough to wait, it's a way that I didn't know anyone in the industry. No one. It may as well been an industry on the moon. So it's not like I could move to Hollywood and I had an in anywhere. So it, you know, I grew up with other working class kids where, you know, like my best friend Jill growing up, her dad was a mechanic for the sheriff's department's helicopters.
Oh, wow.
My dad worked in aerospace, you know, and he started just by sitting on the wings of airplanes and screwing in nuts and bolts, and then worked his way up to basically an engineering job without an engineering education. He's that smart. I inherited none of that ability. So, you know, what am I gonna do? I can't get a real job. I can't count. And I was just in high school and I realized, well, I'm kind of good at the creative stuff and I'm, you know, I like reading and I like writers. You know, I was learning about what writers are like and I thought, I'll be a writer. How's that? And so I get okay grades in that, and that's just how my life started to gravitate the way it did. And I went to community college first, which turned out to be a really good thing for me because as I was figuring things out, I wasn't paying 4-year school prices. I couldn't afford that. And I decided one day I'm gonna be a writer and editor. I want to do books, and I just kind of wanted to be a part of this literary community because I idolized people like Mark Twain and F. Scott Fitzgerald and people like that. And I quickly realized there's just not a lot for people like that in Los Angeles. So, what am I going to do? And I had read an article with Henry Rollins, who was in the punk band Black Flag.
Yeah,
They were
Black
an
Flag.
LA band. And he owned a book company. He still owns a book company, and it's called 21361. He named it after his birthday. And it was just, it started off as like he was doing fold and staple books and he had to register it. So he's like, I'll just name it after my birthday. And then it just kind of stuck. But my birthday is also 213. So it stood out to me. And when I was sitting in class one day, I thought, oh, what am I going to do? I have nowhere to work. I didn't want to leave California, even though I love New York. I didn't want to leave California. And I thought, I'm just going to work for Henry Rollins. Just like,
wait,
here
really?
I am this. Yeah. So I thought, I'm going to work for Henry Rollins. And here I am like this nerdy suburban kid who sets this goal. And I liked Henry Rollins well enough, but I wasn't a hardcore Henry Rollins fan because I grew up with some, they're all guys who worshiped Henry Rollins. So I knew who he was. But he has a very masculine energy. And I was attracted to, you know, Marilyn Monroe and old Hollywood and, you know, suave debonair men kind of a thing. And I was like, I work for Henry Rollins. But at the same time, that aesthetic fit me kind of well too. Anyway, I just started telling people like, yeah, I'm going to work for Henry Rollins. You watch. And one day a friend of mine, one of my Disney colleagues called me and she said, hey, Henry Rollins is going to speak at my school. She was going to Cal State Fullerton. We should go. And I was like, okay. So I went and I started talking to this woman at the book counter selling his books. And it turns out she ran his company. So I said, do you ever take interns? And she said, well, not now, but maybe in a couple months, give us a call. So I did. And they took me on as an intern. And I ended up staying there 2.5 years. And I worked for Henry Rollins. And that was my big break into publishing.
That is crazy. That is,
but it
that
was
is
just
amazing.
Because I had no options. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. I had no connections. So I was just sitting in class one day like, for Henry Rollins. And I did.
It's funny because you see so often, at least portrayed in the movies, is people have their eyes set on like these real big publishing companies and, you know, big jobs. I'm going to write for the Times or, but nobody's like, you know, that kind of hardcore poly punk guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to work for him.
Which should be the best place for me. It was small and you know, it was very grassroots, but, just a couple of employees, but I got to learn some things. And Henry wasn't there a whole lot because he was always on tour. He was, you know, earning a living to keep the publishing company going. But when he was there, he was great to me. He wanted to know what I was studying in school because I transferred to UCLA. So shortly after I got hired at 21361, I transferred to UCLA. So that was my after school job, was 21361. And, you know, he always wanted to know what I was studying. We were both really into Fitzgerald and Hemingway. And at one point I got to actually take a class in just Fitzgerald and Hemingway. So we'd talk about that. And we would talk about jazz because he loves jazz. And I didn't know anything about jazz. He would lend me CDs because it was back in the era of CDs. So when he was there, he was great to me. And then just the regular employees, it was... Carol, Heidi, and Dave. It was almost like a little family. It was a lot of fun.
That is,
and that's
so
how I got
incredibly
into
cool.
publishing. Yeah.
So how many years did you spend with them?
2.5 years. And I'm forever grateful because if it wasn't for that, I don't know if I would have been able to get a job in another company. Eventually I got into magazines and I worked for company that specialized in pet magazines. So that's how I got into the pet publishing industry. But I would have never had that opportunity if I hadn't have had some experience to put on a resume about like, yeah, I worked for this book publishing company. So I owe a lot to them.
So that's pretty incredible. I do like going from working for like a hardcore punk rocker to pet magazines. So
yeah, it's a big shift. It's a hard right turn. But that turned out to be great for me too because I worked on a magazine called Pet Product News, which I think is still around. It goes out to pet stores, you know, pet supply stores. And you know, I assigned articles to freelance writers. I had to do some budgeting. I edited, and that's, you know, editing is a great way to learn how to write or improve your writing skills. So I was there for a long time, and sometimes I would assign myself stories so that I would practice writing. And I always wrote up the new product releases. So, you know, when companies had new flea medications coming out or new leashes, it was my job to write the little announcements. But, you know, it's writing every day. And that's really the key to being a writer, is to write all the time, whether it's something major, like a play or a movie, or writing about the latest litter boxes. You know, it all counts. It all goes somewhere. You're crafting sentences.
It's so true. I said that during a panel years ago when I was still very green writing. Mm-hmm. But it was going places. Like, my satire was getting published. I was getting jokes on late night shows. And people had asked, like, how do you get to that? And I said the same thing. You just have to write every day. So it doesn't matter what you're writing. You just, like, if you sit down and just start typing, I have nothing to write whatsoever today. Like, you're going to find something. Like,
you'll find something.
Like a catharsis that'll get you to that point. And
yeah.
I somehow made people mad. That I was like,
why?
They somehow didn't buy into that notion of just sitting down and writing every day, no matter what it is that you're writing. And I was like, all right, I mean, if you don't want to, but so I love, every time I talk to anybody that's a writer, everybody always says the same thing, is they found a way to write every day. And it truly is what gets you through.
And it's not like I was sitting down fresh out of college, like, yeah, let's write about the latest in litter boxes and food bowls. And this is going to lead to something bigger. It was the job, and I had to do it and get it done by a certain day. And it had to, you know, not have errors in it. And it's only looking back that I realized, hey, that really helped me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's because of that, or, you know, like writing about different things, again, in the pet industry. But, you know, when you have to interview people or just research a lot, those are skills that you can apply to anything, and they will come in useful later.
Yeah, it's very true. And I mean, even especially with like a lot of younger filmmakers and stuff that I know listen, it's the same thing I've always said, even when it comes to filmmaking, is just, you have to make those short films. You've got a phone in your hand that has a camera. Make something. Mm-hmm. Like, be able to tell a story. Figure out what your point of view is. Like, all of those things, no matter how big or how small it is what gets you to the end game. And eventually, when you have, you know, that producer that's going to give you the time of day to talk to them for 15 minutes, being able to show that you can actually carry a project from start to finish. Like, that's all that a lot of these companies want to see, is that, oh, I can put my trust in Elise, or I can put my trust in Tim, because they can do these jobs if we give them the chance to.
And that's one thing I've learned just recently is, you know, I'm really passionate about local history, Southern California history. And I have to be careful as I launch into this, because I can really get on a soapbox. But I get tired of people saying California doesn't have history, you know, there's nothing worth saving there. And the reality is very different.
Yes.
Los Angeles is a different kind of city. You know, if you say we don't have history, well, that's pretty insulting to the indigenous people who lived here
Absolutely.
All those years. And then, you know, we go through the Spaniards and the Mexican era and now the American era, but you know, our city is newer compared to some of the other cities, but it's just different. You know, we always hear about, like, it's spread out and there are cars. And it's like, you know, we really came into our own after the gold rush, after cars, after the oil boom. Movies actually came later. Los Angeles is not built around movies originally. It is kind of is now. Originally, it was built around, you know, like oil and gold and things like that. But there's a lot of history, and I find that Angelenos love it. It's not our fault that buildings get torn down and our history goes away. It's worth preserving. We're just not the ones making those decisions. So I finally realized, you know, why can't I go out and document some of these things? I have an iPhone. You don't have to be a camera crew anymore. You don't have to have producers. And So I started going out and just filming things and writing scripts and, recording myself talking over these videos. And I don't have very many out now because, I work full time and I do freelance stuff. But I realized I have the ability to create this. It's not like you have to go through studios anymore. The walls of the studios have been torn down, and everyone is a potential little studio.
Yeah. No, it's very true. And one thing I would always remind people when it comes to the history out here, because I mean, as you know, I love the history here. And I would remind people that they would come in, they look at Los Angeles and like, but none of these buildings are that old. You go back to New York, and I mean, you got Castle Clinton there next to Battery Park that has history that goes back to the late 1600s. And it's like, yeah, that's great for them. But Los Angeles, when you talk about when people look at Hollywood and Hollywood land, I mean, a lot of that's not even 100 years old yet. I mean, there's chunks that are, but it's like, I mean, even like the Roosevelt Hotel and Grauman's Chinese Theater and some of those that everybody flocks to, like those are the late 1920s. And still, yeah, like we aren't even at 100 years on those yet. Los Angeles was never meant to be what it is now. And so it's sometimes when people complain about even our infrastructure, it's like, there's 4 million people that live in the city of Los Angeles. And just that, like that many people in a city that's basically sprung up in, barely over 100 years. Yeah, it makes people very passive about the amazing history that's happened over that time.
Well, yeah, and there's so much here. The movies are here, and that's what people think about. And of course, that's what they think about because it's the movie industry and it goes out worldwide.
Yeah.
But again, we had shipping and military and aerospace, oil, cars.
Stuff in the Prohibition era, just even that going downtown, even all the way to Venice Beach and some of the speakeasies, like there's so
Well,
much
and
crazy stuff.
there's a lot of personal freedom here. Like if you wanted to worship in a different way, you could come here. If you were gay, you could come here.
Yeah.
It's not nearly like it is now, but it would be easier than other places, and there's a real freedom here, and I think that persists in a good way.
Yeah.
So I like that part of our history. And my family ended up here. Gosh, my grandmother was four, so that would be 1915. And then my grandfather's family came here in the early 1920s. So my family's been here over 100 years, and I've seen all of these changes. And that's why I'm so pro examining the working class, because that's the family I came from. And I
Yeah.
don't appreciate when people are like, oh, everyone out there is just a shallow movie industry person. It's like, you are not talking about my family that way, because they were down on the docks hauling stuff in from the ships on, from areas all over the world. Los Angeles has one of the biggest ports in the country, and
Yeah.
that went out, countrywide. And my family were, they were the ones out hauling that stuff in from the ships. And that means a lot to me. And that's something that's important to the United States. And I think it's super cool that we have the entertainment industry, and that's what sucked me in quite a bit as a kid. But it's not the only thing here. You have to have a 360 degree view.
Yeah, whenever people ask me what they should see when they come here, I know that the main thing they want is all the glitz and glamour. But the way I always turn the question back on them is, well, what is it that you're interested in? Because if they're going to tell me history and they're going to tell me, even just hiking or anything like that, it's like I'm not going to tell them to go to Runyon because that's just the, how many Instagram pictures can we put up? Like, there's so many other areas that you can kind of go explore and enjoy the unique history of it. I mean, even just hiking up to the Griffith Observatory, yeah, it's a very Instagrammy spot, but there's so much history that goes into just Vermont Canyon and going up through there. And yeah, it truly does just get overlooked by all of it. And I mean, to even think back to, knowing that your family were some of the original people here. It's just kind of crazy to think, all that went into their lives in the early days of a city that was trying to decide what it was.
Yeah, and my grandparents, having grown up here before the movie industry was what it is now, they were so not impressed by it. I remember, so I'm kind of, I'm always the alien in the family. Like, I developed this obsession with Marilyn Monroe as a little girl, and they were like, "Where is this kid getting it?" Because even though I grew up here, it was not in the family. Like, my grandmother was telling me about being a, I don't know if she was a teenager or what, but she was down by the port somewhere, and she said this young man who fancied her, that was the term she used. I think he fancied me. He said Clara Bow was about to christen a ship, and let's go see Clara Bow. So he grabbed her hand and they went running outside. They were, right on the port. And she said they were close enough to Clara Bow when she cracked the champagne bottle over the ship that she actually got some of the champagne splashed on her. My grandma was that close. And she started in with, like, oh my God, she was wearing so much makeup and she had these ridiculous eyebrows that were just drawn on her face and these gigantic eyelashes, like, just so not about it. And now here I am, all these years later, planning to go to the Silent Film Festival specifically to see a Clara Bow film that was believed to be lost and is
Oh,
re-premiering because it
wow.
was found in a parking lot. And if that's not full circle for my family, I don't know what is, but it's like, I'm not going to miss that. But I keep thinking back to my grandma being like, oh my God, this woman looked ridiculous in real life. Like, just not impressed.
That's hilarious. Yeah, it is kind of fun to see some of these things come full circle like that for sure,
Yeah.
especially how just unimpressed she was.
She just, like, no one in my family cared. And that's why, my obsession with Marilyn developed. I was probably only about five. I just happened to see Gentlemen Prefer Blondes on television. And it's so cliche and cheesy to say, in that instant, my life changed. But in this case, it's true. Like, in that instant, my life changed. It was like, who is this lady who looks like Barbie?
Yeah.
Everything was pink and sparkly and ballet dancers and hearts and all of a sudden I was obsessed and it just never let up. It was the weirdest thing. And my parents are like, "What is happening to this kid? Where is she getting this?" Because it was just not part of our lives. And my fascination with Hollywood and old Hollywood starts with her, starts with Marilyn. It's not like, I watched old movies with my grandma, and she was telling me about this great story about seeing Clara Bow in person, or, my mom was reading movie magazines. Like, none of that happened. It was just her. It was just Marilyn. And it just grew.
It's kind of crazy too that you got that from, like, people remember going to the theater for the first time and like having that kind of grab them, but you saw it on TV. And so
Yeah,
to just
that
kind of
was.
be a kid at home seeing Gentlemen Prefer Blondes for the first time,
With
and I mean
commercials and everything.
it's a very, I mean the music in that is so catchy. I mean Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend is, I mean still
Yeah.
you can, if you say that phrase, people have that whole song in their head the rest of the day. And
Yeah.
it's
It's a
so
whole
catchy.
thing.
Yeah.
And we just saw a couple weeks ago Ryan Gosling spoofing,
Yeah.
or maybe paying homage, however you want to look at it, Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, but from a man's point of view, I thought it was adorable. There
I
was
loved
a
it, yeah.
couple people. There was a couple of people who didn't appreciate it. Was he making fun of Marilyn? I don't think so. I think he was really making a statement,
Yeah,
and
they were definitely paying homage to,
I think
I
so.
mean the fact that it comes from, it's from Barbie, and then they're, paying homage to Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I mean, it's a very kind of tongue-in-cheek joke, but it's definitely
Yeah.
playing homage.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. And Marilyn never won an Oscar. And here she is, honored basically at the Oscars, 60, almost 62 years after her death. And we
Yeah.
know exactly who he's referencing.
Yeah, I mean, all the dancers in the background were dressed pretty much
Wasn't
identical.
that great?
Yeah, it was. As soon as that moment came, I was like, I've seen this before.
I know. And I loved it. And they had so much detail, even down to. In the original number, they had women holding lights, they were kind of like the chandeliers or whatever. And in Ryan Gosling's, they had men doing the same thing. And it's kind of hard to see, but when he comes up from the audience and walks up the steps on the stairs, you see one of those men and he fist bumps one of them and the lights go on. So he illuminates those guys. And it's just like, oh, the level of detail. I mean, you really have to love something to pay that much attention to it. So I appreciated it. And yeah, I don't know why they picked it, other than maybe the lyrics refer to blonde fragility, and they were thinking, who is a better fragile blonde than Marilyn? Or I don't know, but you know, Marilyn as Lorelai in that movie really turns gender roles on its head, because she is smarter than you think, and she kind of outwits the men in the movie. And then Barbie is turning gender roles left on their heads, left and right, all the way through the movie, both men and women. So I thought it fit.
No, I think it fit very, very well. And a lot of people did like to play down Marilyn. She's always been somebody I've been fascinated by. I was telling my wife just the other night, because I was like, you know, I haven't watched some of these movies in a while. And literally this morning while eating breakfast, I was finishing up a rewatch on Some Like It Hot, because I hadn't watched that in ages. And a couple of years ago, got to hold Ori Kelly's Oscar for costume design for that.
Yeah, so, I've held that Oscar too.
Yeah, and so it's like, you know, it's an important piece. And I told my wife, I was like, I remember years ago going into a Hollywood Video and renting like 7 Year Itch and renting Some Like It Hot and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And the person at the counter just kind of being like, the hell? Like, because this is Salt Lake City, and like nobody is necessarily out there just renting a stack of Marilyn movies. And it was because I had no idea really who she was. She was just somebody you would hear about and that you knew she died young. Like, it was one of those things that you just didn't know. And so the more that my fascination in film grew, I wanted to know more about who this woman was, because she was kind of just mysterious. In a way.
Yeah. And the thing about Marilyn, or great art, is great art will bring people together, whether it's music or paintings. There's a connection between humans. And, you know, I guess going back to why I always loved writers so much, you know, if you can put into words what people are feeling, what a gift. And I think movies can do that too. But there is something about Marilyn that brings people together, and I would put her in the great artist category. And I know I get a lot of pushback on that, because she's just an actress, and then she's a bombshell on top of that. People don't want to really give her credit because she's platinum blonde and has red lips and she's shapely, and she kind of utilizes her femininity to her advantage.
Yeah.
And people don't want to see her as, you know, in the same level as a Picasso or an F. Scott Fitzgerald or even an Elvis Presley or Beatles. But she really is. She does everything that they do in terms of bringing people together or making you examine who you are, whether it's through the lens of one of her movies or her life. Because, you know, like Some Like It Hot, man, talk about turning gender roles on their heads. That movie is so ahead of her time, and she was part of that, and it's her performance, her interpretation of that character, that makes it great. So yeah, she is working with someone else's lines, but the performance is her own, and that's what she brings to it. And the same goes for any actor in that movie. If you can bring people together and make people examine themselves. And I would put Marlon Brando into that category too. I mean, the way he revolutionized acting and made it more realistic. A Streetcar Named Desire is playing on the big screen in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to go see it on the big screen. I'm so excited. But to see him in that movie and that raw energy, he is just cutting to the core of who we are as human beings. And it's not always pretty. In fact, it's usually not. But he somehow taps into that and makes you see it on screen the same way, like when you hear poetry or a good song, and they can crystallize something we're experiencing. You can do it visually if you're an actor too. So that's kind of how I see it.
No, and Brando also is a great example there. And, you know, where people pigeonhole Marilyn so much, they pigeonhole him even quite a bit. I mean, you bring up Brando to most people and they're going to just, oh, The Godfather. And it's like, no, in a movie like Streetcar, where you're getting young Brando even. Mm-hmm. So his role, he's so cutting. You can't take your eyes off of him when he is on the screen.
No, and the thing is, like, and he did some movies later in life where he was dialing it in and, you know, accepting a paycheck. But at the same time, Superman. You still can't take your eyes. Yeah. You still can't take your eyes off of him. You know, he has so much of a presence that, you know, him dialing it in is a better performance than most actors trying really hard.
Yeah. So with Marilyn, the thing that always kind of broke my heart, and I know your book kind of dives into it, mm-hmm. is, you know, people do kind of just push her aside and do write her off in a way. And she had such a difficult and sad life, even leading up to her getting to Hollywood. I mean, her childhood was so heartbreaking, bouncing from foster homes, you know, being molested as a child by you know, potential foster, and, you know, so much
having to get married.
16. To contemplate, you know, should I be getting married at 16 years old just so that, you know, she could be free, essentially. It's so heartbreaking to think of all that she went through, that when people want to kind of discount the fact that she was a blonde bombshell with the red lipstick, and she had, you know, pill problems and things, and it's just like, but why? Like, what led to that? Like, people aren't born, you know, with problems or born a mess that way.
Things stem from it. Yeah, and I think with her, you know, for me, and this is how I interpret her, I see her as incredibly brave.
Yeah.
She had all of that against her. She grew up in poverty. During the Depression, everyone was in poverty. Most people were. An orphan. And I know people will argue with me. She wasn't an orphan. She had a mother. Yeah, but her mother was institutionalized. Her mother wasn't there. Her father wouldn't acknowledge her. She found escape in movies. The person she attached herself to was really Clark Gable, and to a major extent, Jean Harlow. She patterned her look after Jean Harlow.
Yeah.
But Jean Harlow passed away, and Clark Gable lived. So she continued to kind of obsess on him, and would even pretend or fantasize that he was her real dad, because she was so desperate to have a connection, like a fatherly connection. So I see her as brave because she was like, I'm going to grow up to be a movie star. People love you when you're in movies. And I can express myself. Again, that artistic spirit, you know, like, I'm not going to be able to function in real life. And she definitely needed some sort of expressive outlet. So she fixated on the movies. She grew up right in town. She could see the RKO water tower from the orphanage window. It's now the Paramount Tower, but back then RKO. And she would stare at it at night. And it goes back to, like, I'm going to do this. Kind of like, work for everyone. She was like, I'm going to be in movies. And she did it. And most people not only become a successful actor, but she started with the least and became the most famous. She became the most well-known. And you don't get to be that kind of person unless you're really smart, have a lot of inner strength, and lead a life of conviction. That's how I see her. And was she a victim at certain points? Yeah, she was. Look at her life. But she just kept going. And Arthur Miller, who was married to her for a while, said he said she was the bravest person he knew up until, you know, she decided she wanted to leave. And even then, it's, you know, I almost respect the fact that she decided her time was done. So that's how I see Marilyn. And I see her as a great artist. And kind of like, I get frustrated and angry when people discount Los Angeles, I get frustrated and angry when people discount her, because it's like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. What this woman accomplished, blows everyone else away.
Yeah, if it didn't, we wouldn't be talking about her, you know, 62 years later since she passed.
Yeah.
You know, she's had such a mark on so many of us, on this industry, on the world, mm-hmm. that her name still is mentioned today. I mean, we still are making movies about her.
Most of them bad, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, well, yeah, whether good or bad, we're still, like, she still is in the conversation because she was so impactful.
Yeah, she's the great American Sphinx.
Yeah, that is a great way of putting it. So I will say, when I bought Hello, Norma Jean, I was not expecting 403 pages. Your research on this... When you buy a book somebody has written that's, you know, about a celebrity's life, a lot of the times it is, you know, the same meat and potatoes that everybody else has written. Mm-hmm. Your book takes it on a whole different avenue. Mm-hmm. Of like, here's her life, but let's really get into it. And so I love that, you know, mm-hmm. it's the, as you have on the cover, the Marilyn Monroe you didn't know. Mm-hmm. And it really does take you through every bit of Los Angeles and mm-hmm. everywhere she went. It lets you almost in a way live in her shoes. And I think that was such a unique way that you went about this book.
So thank you so much for saying that, because that was the goal. There are a lot of books about her out there. Some of them are really bad, but there are a lot of good ones too. But I didn't want to redo a traditional biography, because that's already been done. I can recommend you some. And what I wanted was, you know, through all my years of researching and obsessing, is I always wanted to know who she was, like, what was her shoe size and what did she eat? And, you know, what was she doing that night when she got home from work and that kind of thing. And so I've just spent a lifetime of literally retracing her steps and trying to find all this stuff out. And my idea was to finally just create a book where you almost turn her life, instead of the outside looking in, like, let's get in, break it up piece by piece, and examine her like you would, almost like a math problem, or that's not a good way to put it, but, you know, going from the inside out. Yeah. And because I grew up in Southern California, starting as a kid, when I'd say, like, Mom, can we go look at this? And then me getting my own driver's license and doing it myself. It's just a lifetime of tracing, you know, where did she go and what did she do? What does it look like now? And just to realize, like, wow, she really did grow up right in the heart of Hollywood, or in the valley, which is just over the hill. And, you know, when she was living at the Studio Club and working at Columbia, you could walk from the Studio Club to Columbia, and you could walk to the Egyptian. You know, she was a little girl walking to the Chinese theater and putting her little handprints in the cement handprints of her idols, just like people do now. And she would walk to the Egyptian. She really lived it. And, you know, and my thought is, she's so complex and fascinating that I wanted other people to experience that too.
Yeah, and I think anybody who buys the book, especially where you've got maps, even they kind of showcase it. People really can, like, it really walk in the same routes she walked, be able to experience that. And yeah, it's such a unique experience. Even going through it, because, I mean, as you know, I love going and finding some of these old
places. I do too.
As I was digging through your book, and I'm just like, oh, I need to go pay this one a visit. I need to go check out this spot.
Yeah, you can literally, like, to see how close, like, the orphanage where she lived for a while, you can walk to the school where she went to school. All the orphans, you know, they all walk to school together. Mm-hmm. You can see how close it is, and it's like, oh, wow. So you get to know her better, and that was the goal, is, like, you know her, you understand her, and you really start to see her for the person she is, rather than the image she created, because the image she created is so powerful that it eclipses the real person a lot of times. She's not the only one who has had that happen. I mean, you can look at people like Elvis or John Wayne, even now Madonna, like the image is so powerful, it's easy to forget there's an actual human being behind that who gets up in the morning and takes a shower and eats breakfast and then, works on their craft. And that was the person I'm interested in. And I find that that person is usually more interesting than the image. Oh, another great example would be Charlie Chaplin. We always think of the Little Tramp. And how powerful is that image? That's one of the first great ones from movie history. And you see him out of makeup, you don't even recognize him.
Right. Yeah, I had the opportunity to visit the Chaplin studio, now the Jim Henson Company, back in December. And I mean, for once, seeing the pictures of Charlie and his brother, like breaking ground for the studio there. I mean, there are many moments that I would just get chills and like my eyes would just kind of well up because walking around and seeing, like, I don't think people think of Chaplin and his hat and his big shoes and doing the little tramp walk and all of that. But they don't realize that, like, he literally built a studio by hand. Like, they still, when you walk onto that little teeny lot, they still have their version of, I mean, for us, when I say the mill, we've at Warner Brothers, we have a massive mill where all the sets and everything are built.
Yeah.
They had their mill and they still have this giant saw at the Chaplin Studios that where he would have pulled down the saw where they were literally, he was cutting the wood himself and taking it over to stage one where he could build the set. Like, he had his hands in everything trying to create, and in his day and age, trying to, tell the stories that he told. He was so far ahead of his time that he was pissing people off around him. I mean, The Great Dictator, I think one of the greatest movies ever made.
Yeah.
And boy, did that ruffle feathers, and still is so relevant today, sadly.
Yeah.
Still so relevant today.
Yeah, great art will stand the test of time. And you don't know what's going to stand the test of time when you're in the middle of it.
Yeah.
That's the one unfortunate thing. F. Scott Fitzgerald, I know I keep coming back to F. Scott Fitzgerald, but I love him. When he died, he thought he was going to be forgotten. And there was a whole warehouse filled with unsold copies of The Great Gatsby. And now it's considered the great American novel alongside Huck Finn. And that poor man didn't know that when he died. But, that's my favorite book. But I do think it is a great American novel because he was touching on things that still resonate. And it's like almost like he predicted the future in a weird way. It's like, wow, how did he do that?
Yeah. And I mean, even F. Scott Fitzgerald with Mark Twain, as you mentioned, Huck Finn.
Yeah.
Going back and even visiting some of their spots, like I had the opportunity, I mean, it's been almost 20 years now since I visited Hannibal, Missouri. And
that would be great.
One of my favorite little towns in this entire country. I mean, I've been fortunate to travel all over this country. And Hannibal, Missouri is a place that will always stand out in my mind because it's what really was where Tom and Huck and Becky Thatcher and all of that. I mean, the cave that he talks about in those books, I have been inside that cave.
Yeah, so, and it's preserved, like, so that you can see it.
And like they have, and there's been some in recent years that have kind of tried to dispute this, but like Jesse James had hidden out in there and his name is like etched in the wall. And there's also, like, you could actually visit where Becky Thatcher's grave was and where Huck's house, like who Huck is based on, like was supposed to be. And it's one of those that you walk in that those footprints and follow it where Mark Twain, what inspired him. And it's so crazy to watch some of that history come to life. And it's sad, as you mentioned, people look at LA history and they don't respect it the way that we do necessarily others. And we see, areas, places that Maryland have been, people that Clark Gable, some of these big stars' homes that have been recently purchased and demolished because it's the old style.
Yeah.
We want, for some reason, these boxes, sterile boxes.
Just a couple weeks ago, one of Rita Hayworth's houses was torn down. And the inside of it, but a friend of mine is a Rita Hayworth expert. Hi, Karen. He wrote a book on Rita Hayworth. That house went up for sale. And she managed to get in. She got an appointment to go in. And the house was exactly as Rita Hayworth had left
That's
it. And
amazing.
she lined up pictures of herself where Rita was standing. It was just perfection. And just a couple weeks ago, it's completely gone. It's a hole in the ground.
Yeah, that's I just saw last night that Bob Barker's home has now gone up for sale.
I know. I saw that. I follow these things because I love architecture. I
Yeah.
love history. And I saw that, and it's an immaculate 1929 Spanish style house in
And he's only
Outpost
the
Estates.
second or third owner, or something like that.
Yeah, well, he was there since the 50s or something. And all the original details are still there.
Yeah.
And whoever buys it, please, please, please leave it intact because that is so rare now. What you have is better than anything new because what you have is special and different and rare. So keep that in mind. I mean, we're so into the HGTV, Home Depot,
Yeah.
Lowe's era where you just knock everything down and everyone has the same faucet and the same
Right.
tile.
I mean, the only thing I get looking through a bunch of the real estate pictures from it, I was like, yeah, I would maybe upgrade the shower so it was a little less murdery, but
Yeah.
it's like there were a
Well,
few things, but
you have upkeep.
yeah, but like overall, like to have that old 1920s style to all of it. Like it was
Yeah, but
amazing to see even the fireplace. I was like, oh my God, like this is the original fireplace from the late 1920s, all
the
hand
original
carved.
fireplace
Oh.
and that beautiful wood ceiling and the original wood floors. My mom watches a lot of HGTV, and one of the Property Brothers bought a house in a historic neighborhood in Los Angeles, and they turned it into a show to restore it because everything has to make money, everything has to be a show. Well,
Right.
you can't have a show if you're like, yeah, I'm going to keep everything pretty much like it is. So you have to gut everything. And I watched the first few minutes and they were tearing up an original wood floor. And I was like, peace out. I
Jeez.
cannot participate in this because I was literally starting to choke up and cry. And I know it sounds dramatic, but it's just like that's another piece of history gone
Yeah.
forever. And I don't think we should live in the past. But I don't think we should tear it down either. There is a happy medium.
Yeah, there is a house that's just a few streets above us here in Los Feliz that and please nobody come at me for saying Los Feliz. I know it's probably Los Feliz.
I say
I will
Los Feliz,
never
tomato,
pronounce it
tomato.
correctly. But I was it had gone up for sale a couple years ago. This is pre-pandemic and very reasonable price for the neighborhood it was in.
For
And
the neighborhood.
there's a little private neighborhood kind of right above us where a lot of stars live, but a lot of normal people live too. And the prices there are pretty normal for kind of nicer LA homes. They're not in like your $20 million range. Like they're, couple million, like the 2 to 3. So
Lower
like,
class neighborhood.
the low class millionaires.
Yeah.
But one of these went up and it was just so amazing. Just gorgeous views of the whole city. And it was one that my wife and I looked at and we're like, oh, this is like a dream house. And I'm just out for a walk one day. I'm going down Franklin, and they had a back gate that kind of let out onto it. And one of the owners was coming out, and like I had to stop so he could get out of the gate. And as he comes out, I said, "Hey, look, this is weird." And I was like, "But I saw your listing on Zillow. I just have to say, you guys have such an incredible house. Like, this is so amazing. I really hope people keep it as it is because it was an old 1920s house."
My
And
favorite.
"He said, yeah, we really hope so too. Some of the people that are looking to put an offer and want to knock out one of the kitchen walls." And I immediately was like, you can't do that. It loses it. And he was just like, we don't want them to
Oh,
have."
it's so nice.
Like I was devastated of him telling me that this house that like we had loved so much, like, oh, you can't do that. Don't hurt this home because
I
there was just
know.
so much history there that we wanted that to stay preserved.
Well, and the architects back then were artists. They were craftsmen. They were scientists because a whole lot of math involved in architecture. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. They knew what they were doing. That wall is there for a reason.
Yeah.
Please keep it there.
Yeah, there's just so much. I mean, I am very lucky that Frank Lloyd Wright has a lot of properties all right around us. I mean, I could walk out my front door and be able to look up and see like a couple of Frank Lloyd Wright houses. And like just to be able to have like that architecture too. Is amazing.
Yeah, and we have Lloyd Wright, the son. We have Paul Revere Williams, who was the first Black architect to have a license in California. And he was as great as any of the white guys. He wasn't just the first. He was one of the best.
Yeah.
And what he had to go through to work, you know, he kind of became the guy everyone wanted to go to because he was the best. But he also had to do things like learn how to draw upside down, because when he was meeting with prospective clients, he knew being African-American, that would be uncomfortable for some white people, not all, but for some. So instead of sitting next to the client at a table and drawing, sketching out what they wanted, he would sit across from them and draw upside down just in case it made them more comfortable. Or when he was on a job site, he would always make sure he was dressed in a suit so that he would be taken seriously. And he would walk around with his hands casually kind of clapped behind his back, like, oh, I'm just here casually. But he did that because he didn't want any of the white folks to feel obligated to shake his hand, because he didn't know if that would make anyone uncomfortable. And my thought is like, wow, that guy had to put up with that while creating some of the best masterpieces we have in the city. And for him to have to worry about that while he's trying to do something extraordinary and build something you can actually live in, you know, which is no easy feat, he's having to deal with that too. And then we also have Julia Morgan, who was one of the first, if not the first, woman to get a license for architecture in California. And she went on to create Hearst Castle and the Examiner Building in downtown. And she did the Studio Club and the YWCA, and like not just a female, but one of the greats. And, you know, the fact that we have to worry about their buildings is just beyond comprehension to me.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, luckily we do have some societies out here that have really taken it upon themselves to try and get, I mean, it's crazy that people are so eager to tear things down that even the Lloyd Chaplin Keaton Alley just along Cahuenga in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Like, we had to be able to preserve an alleyway that some very iconic shots from Harold Lloyd and Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. I had found out about it kind of ahead of the dedication, and I had to go visit it immediately. And it was just so weird to me. It's like, yeah, it's just an alleyway, but it is such a historical alleyway. When you realize things that were made there, like, to lose that would be devastating in a way. And I'm sure people are gonna listen to that and be like, it's an alleyway, but
you know, sometimes individuals have to do it. You kind of have to fight money with money, like fighting fire with fire. Hugh Hefner, of all people, saved the Hollywood sign. There was a big movement in the 70s. The Hollywood sign got so dilapidated that it was literally falling down, and people donated money to save it. And then, I was going to say a few years ago, he's been gone a few years. Someone wanted to start building houses, like do a housing development right underneath the Hollywood sign. That is literally one of the most famous spots in the world. Everyone knows the Hollywood sign, and someone's like, yeah, let's put a development there. And Hugh Hefner stepped in, bought the land, and then donated it so that it's protected forever. And I know a lot of people have mixed feelings about Hugh Hefner. I do too. But in this case, I am very grateful to him for stepping in and saying, no, we can't let this happen. This is a cultural and historical landmark, and we are going to protect it.
Yeah. And thank God he did, because it is something that is very important to the city.
Mm-hmm. And Don Henley did something similar for the Walden area, you know, with Thoreau's Walden Pond. And it's like, I can't believe that an individual has to step in and say, no, I'm going to do what the government should be doing, and I am going to put a stop to this. But thank God those people exist, because they matter.
Yeah. So now, but before we wrap things up, one last thing I kind of wanted to touch on, as I kind of mentioned, you know, I came across your book on the Rockhaven Sanitarium.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about saving buildings. I've been very familiar
with it for a series I used to do online that I had called 31 Days of Horror, just going through places that are haunted. Huh? And yeah. Rockhaven Sanitarium is one that will always stand out to me on my list. Now, I have some that have stood out to me because they absolutely terrified me, like the Cecil Hotel. Huh? That place forever. Like, I would never set foot inside that place. That is terrifying to me. But the Rockhaven Sanitarium, the hauntings reported there were never anything scary. They were always very sweet. Mm-hmm. And when I was recording there, it was one of the few places that it did feel very peaceful, despite everything that kind of went on behind those gates, being a sanitarium. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like now things were kind of at peace. How did you kind of get to know that place, and what interested you so much about writing about it?
So I think you're right on the money. And the fact that you've just said all that means Agnes Richards was successful in her approach. The way I came to it is, again, through Marilyn, because her mother was schizophrenic. And that's why she was institutionalized in state hospitals. When Marilyn started making decent money, she placed her mother in Rockhaven because it was a private sanitarium. It was much nicer than state-run places. Marilyn and her mother didn't have a very close relationship. I mean, they couldn't, because her mother was schizophrenic and had been sent away, and she wasn't capable of connecting. But Marilyn did that for her, which I thought was really sweet. And then I found out there was going to be a tour of it one day. And I thought, well, I have to see this because Marilyn put her mother there, and I want to see, you know, what the big deal is. So I got there, and I don't know what I was expecting, other than maybe I thought I was walking into One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or what, because that's really the image I think a lot of us have.
Yeah.
And that's a powerful movie too, which is based on reality. But I walked in and I thought, this place is magic. Like, it's beautiful, it's peaceful. And I went on the tour. The woman who was leading the tour is named Joanna. She's now one of my good friends. And I thought, people need to know about this, because the thing about Rockhaven is it was started by a psychiatric nurse, Agnes Richards, RN, registered nurse. And she worked a lot with World War I soldiers who were coming home and were shell-shocked, what we would now call PTSD. And she learned about things, you know, what helped their illnesses, what made them retreat into their illnesses. She built on that and moved to sanitariums that catered to both men and women. And she continued to just observe what was happening, what helped, what didn't. And she observed that these big, scary buildings that look like hospitals or prisons were scary, not just to the patients, but to the family members who were dropping them off. Yeah. Looks like a jail. They're scared. And that's not going to help their mental health. She also observed that, you know, these are vulnerable people, especially the women who would be around other residents who were men or predatory employees. And so women were violated. And that was really hard for her to see, because they didn't have the ability or the capability to stand up for themselves. Maybe they weren't believed or they couldn't communicate. She noticed that. So she finally decided, I'm going to do this better. I think I can do this better. So she got some property. She started with six women, and she just rented a house. Eventually she bought that house, and she decided, I am not having a big, scary hospital. We are going to have little houses. So she moved bungalows to the property, and they were real houses with bedrooms, dining rooms, bathrooms. And you didn't live there by yourself. You had roommates, but it felt like a home. It felt safe. And everyone ate in the same dining room, but the dining room was decorated to look like a family home. So again, you were safe. You were around people who cared for you. The only people who were hired were women. So the women who lived there were safe. You know, the doctors back then were men, but they weren't there all the time. They would come, you know, do their checkups and leave. The women who were taking care of the other women were safe. And that respect was built even into the administration. So it was from top to bottom. They were not inmates or patients or anything that she had heard before. They were ladies. They were residents. And that's how they were referred to. She kept them busy with crafts, with gardening. They got the best health care available at the time. You know, and a lot of women were just hospitalized for depression or postpartum depression, or, you know, Gladys ended up there. She was schizophrenic, but it was a safe place to be. And it opened in 1923. That's just 3 years after women got the right to vote. So there weren't a lot of options for women. So this woman who didn't have many options for herself then creates career paths for the women who worked there. So it's not just beneficial to the women who were getting treated, but to the women who worked there. And it's a historic landmark for women, for mental health, and even business. And it's constantly in danger of getting torn down. And Joanna and her team, the Friends of Rockhaven, have been working for years to save this place. And I thought, I have to do something. This place is amazing. And I sat down and started writing the book. And thank goodness, Joanna and Mike and some of the other Friends of Rockhaven team were really accommodating to me and helped me with my research and gave me access to their files. So I'm grateful to them. And it helped. A senator read the book, and he allocated $8 million to save the property. And he was doing that in honor of the women in his family, like his mother and his sister, because he thought, wow, this is a women's place. Now that the buildings are still sitting there rotting because of city politics. They want the land to redevelop it and turn it into something with higher density. So even though they've been allocated the funds to save it, and it has been designated a historic landmark through the state, it is still sitting there because, you know, the city of Glendale won't do what they're supposed to do. But it is an amazing piece of property, and I'm so glad you brought the book up because, again, I hate to say it, it changed my life that day, but it did, because I realized there is a world out here that needs to be discovered, and this place matters, and people need to know about it.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And like I said, you know, my visit was the same thing where it felt, and I've never been behind the gates. I knew they did tours. No, I knew they did tours. And it's one that I've always wanted to go on one of their tours. But even just recording, you know, right outside like the old gates that say Rockhaven on them, like it, it was such a peaceful, like I walked around a lot of the property just from the outside to really get a look. And it was just a very just peaceful feeling and just sad knowing what, you know, so many people went through to get, you know, behind those gates, but knowing that, you know, that Agnes Richards had taken the time to make it a safe space. It truly felt special. And it's amazing that all these years later, being a completely, you know, new person to the story, literally reading about it and writing up what we were covering, getting there, I mean, it touched me. And that was, you know, 4 years ago.
Well, and even, you know, the city not taking care of it, the property is starting to crumble, and you can, that's sad to see. And you can see where the gardens were, but it's still there. Like you go onto the property and you can see past the tiles falling off the roof and the dead flowers and that kind of thing. You know, it's a special place. And in the 60s, when antidepressants started coming out and getting prescribed, a lot of their clientele changed to dementia patients because people could be treated at home for depression. And that's where Billy Burke died, the good witch from Wizard of Oz. And again, it was a safe place for her in her final years. And what a special thing to provide that safety and that level of care for people who are at their most vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I hope that more people will learn about it. And I mean, the best way they can is picking up your book. So the full title for anybody searching is Rockhaven Sanitarium, The Legacy of Agnes Richards. So anybody can pick it up on Amazon, as well as Hello, Norma Jean. Just go on a full Lisa kick. Pay Lisa's rent this month. Buy her book. So, Elisa, I appreciate you taking the time, especially on a day off, to come on and talk about your books, talk about, you know, our history and everything. Anywhere, any plugs for anybody to be able to find you, any social media handles?
Yeah. I'm on Facebook, you know, facebook.com/LA Woman Tours, because I used to do tours at the city, but pre-COVID. I'm also on Instagram, LA Woman Tours. So that's LA_Woman_Tours_. I'm easy to find. And I also have a podcast, All Things Maryland. So you can find me there. We're on everywhere you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram. So we are debunking Maryland myths one by one, and just again talking about who she was as a person. So that's me.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, and guess I'll see you at work at some point next week. So
yeah, see you tomorrow. No, thank you so much for having me on and getting the word out about, you know, my books and Rockhaven and Maryland and my feelings on architecture of all things, and the city. You know, I'm really passionate about it, so I appreciate the opportunity very much.
Absolutely. All right, we'll talk soon.
Okay, bye.